Lecture 19, The Early Modern Period, 1450 to 1750.
Today we'll be talking about the early modern period in world history, a period that runs roughly 1450 to roughly 1750, the next period after the great post-classical millennium. The period warrants two comments by way of general introduction. First, it's obviously fairly short. We've been dealing with 1,500 years for the classical period, 1,000 years for the post-classical, and now we're talking about 300. And the reasons for this are probably threefold, and I won't even pretend to say which is most important. First of all, change may have speeded up. That's a modern impression, and maybe it's true. I'm honestly not sure, worth thinking about. Second, as we get closer to the present, we know more. There are more abundant records. That's pretty obvious, but it also helps historians feed larger sections of their treatments. And third, I think quite legitimately, you need to spend more time on periods that are closer to the present day because inevitably they will have even more influence on current patterns of activity. These connections we'll be working on through the discussions from this point onward, but they're perfectly legitimate. This is a perfectly honest, indeed useful, employment of historical analysis. The period begins 1450 or so. We talked last time about some of the components that were changing in the world in 1450, including the new European expeditions, the significant changes in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, the Chinese decision, which helped set the stage for new activity as well. Some historians would urge maybe 1500's a bit better date. By 1500, it was becoming clear that the Europeans had arrived in the Americas and were actually going to utilize their arrival to introduce significant changes. That obviously was not even on the horizon clearly in 1450. And also by 1500, the Ottoman Empire had expanded from its hold in southwestern Europe, northeastern Middle East, to include victories over Egyptian forces that extended the Ottoman Empire through much of the Arab world, not all of it, but much of it, including portions of North Africa, Egypt, obviously front and center. So 1450, 1500 gets things started. 1750 at the other end is frankly a date of convenience. It really is used mainly to say, well, it's around this time that things are going to be changing because of the impact of European industrialization. Not an entirely satisfactory decision. We'll have to talk about it when we talk about the next period in world history. This is an unusual case in which the boundaries of a period at the end are frankly pretty vague. But let's be honest, that's the way it's usually done. Early modern, obviously, is meant to be revealing. It's not quite modern, hence early, but it's a lot more recognizable in terms of our world today than the post-classical was. It's a term that was long used in European history. I don't think it's a distortion to use it in world history, but we need to recognize what some of the implications are. The second general comment about the early modern period is really a warning. This is where many well-intentioned world history educational programs go off the rails. For example, the California state system. California established elegant parameters for world history up to 1450, interesting treatments of Islam, of Asia, of Africa, etc. But then in 1450, the world becomes Europe. And two things happen. One, the expansion of European power, which is undeniable, becomes the central theme so that everything is organized around how societies were reached by Europe, how they reacted to Europe as though they had no independent volition, no independent background, and that just oversimplifies and distorts. The second thing that happens is European history is suddenly given a richness. We're indulging ourselves in looking at the glories of changes in the West as if nothing else were going on elsewhere, as if these developments need to receive a degree of attention that simply distracts from the continued complexity of the world as a whole. So in dealing with the early modern period, we must recognize that the power of Western Europe in the world did increase. That's a legitimate major change. we must recognize that the nature of the West itself was significantly transformed in ways that were obviously important in the West and would have implications for other regions. But we must keep balance. I think it's easy to do, but we need to keep the warning in mind. Europe did not run the world in 1750. Many societies continued to act in great independence of Europe. Important developments continued to occur that had very little to do with Europe one way or the other. The world continued to be complicated. The world continued to operate along several parallel lines. In establishing a new period, as we discussed when we talked about the introduction of the post-classical period, we need not only to have a set of dates, here 1450 or so, 1750 or so, we also have to have a fairly clear sense that the themes that had previously predominated have lost some force. And this is fairly actually easy to state. The post-classical period, lots of things going on, the post-classical period was defined above all by a clear expansion in the geographical range and number of civilizations, by the impact of the world religions, and by the establishment of a world network connecting different parts of Africa, Asia, and Europe. The theme of expansion of civilization obviously can continue to be played in the early modern period, but because the main contours of the civilization zones are pretty well established, particularly outside of the Americas, it's no longer a dominant organizing principle. World religions did continue to expand. Islam is still moving into Southeast Asia, and obviously the Ottoman conquests introduced the possibility of a significant Muslim minority in Southeastern Europe as well. Christianity would expand hugely in the Americas during the early modern period, although not quite as rapidly as some priests and monks had hoped. But for the world as a whole, the religious map was pretty well set, and the big impact of world religions really had come and gone in terms of a major innovative force. Their sustaining power is still there. The world network simply gets transformed. It's still an operative concept, but it gets transformed because of the inclusion of the Americas. So the world network was an intense interrelationship among different societies in what we might conveniently call the old world. The new world economy, which we'll explore more fully next time, the new world economy is literally global. And that's a huge change. Indeed, and now we turn to the most important part, what are the new themes? Indeed, the most important single development in the early modern period is the intensification of interregional trade connections and the inclusion of the Americas, and at the very end of the period, the inclusion also of Pacific Oceania in these global trade patterns. Huge development, pretty obvious, but the implications are immense. Other changes, other new themes include, and these are what we're going to explore during the balance of our discussion today, other new changes include the new power relationship of the West and the world. Didn't happen overnight. It has to be seen as gradual, but it did occur. The biological exchanges that resulted from European and African contact with the Americas. And finally, the explosion, no pun intended, of gunpowder empires. A point that relates to the expansion of Europe but needs separate attention. First, the expansion of Europe. This can be very simply summed up, and there's a nice book by Carla Cipolla precisely along these lines, as Gun Sales and Empires. By the 15th century, Europeans had adapted Chinese explosive powder into guns and particularly cannon. They benefited, interestingly, from the fact that well before the advent of Chinese explosive powder in Europe, Europeans were already familiar with heavy metal casting, interestingly, for the purpose of making church bells. Now, nobody sat around when church bells were being developed saying, say, I think several centuries from now this will make a great weapon. But the fact is, another bit of dumb luck. Europeans were able to transfer this technology to the casting of bronze and iron cannon. Sales came from adaptations of Arab shipping. Europeans learned how to make more effective ocean-going vessels. They stopped depending on galley slaves to row through the Mediterranean, and these new vessels proved to be particularly successful in navigating the waters of the Atlantic and then the Pacific. Along with guns and sails came, of course, the increasing utilization of navigational devices, most of which the Europeans had borrowed from elsewhere, the compass, etc., and the Europeans were off and running. For the most part, guns and sails in the early modern period took Europeans mainly to islands and coastal regions where they could establish ocean-going contact and use their sea-based cannon to intimidate and threaten. Thus, Europeans over the early modern period seized some port cities in West Africa, occasionally a bit in East Africa, though the European presence was much less significant there. They seized some ports in India, like the Portuguese port of Goa, which was only given back to India a few years ago. They seized island groups in what's now Indonesia. They periodically seized territory in Taiwan. They certainly seized the Philippines. These were places where ships cannon, and short-distance expeditions from ships would pay off particularly well. It's obviously vital to recognize, no mystery, but it's obviously vital to recognize that with rare exceptions, the interior of Africa and Asia would remain immune to European conquest at this point. The technology was simply not relevant. Europeans made inroads in African territories directly only in Angola, a Portuguese holding, and then a bit later on in South Africa, where the Dutch established a foothold. But otherwise, their dealings with Africa in terms of the use of ships and force are coastal, as is the case with most of Asia. The huge exception, of course, was the Americas, where Europeans had the advantage not just of ships and guns, though this was certainly relevant, but also metal tools and technologies, horses, and a sense of military organization that, in some instances at least, was also superior to that which had been developed among Native American peoples. The European conquest of the Americas, which was gradual, let's not assume that Europeans suddenly, because they made huge land claims over South America, for example, seized these territories fully. But European success here was absolutely vital, but in terms of the world as a whole, atypical. And remember, it was accompanied by another advantage the Europeans had, if advantage is the right word, that they did not have with regard to Asia and Africa, and that was the advantage of disease. The decimation of American populations because of imported diseases, running up to 80 to 85% of the total Native American population dying off within two centuries, whole populations in some cases literally entirely extinguished, minorities remaining in other instances. This cleared the way for European conquest as no other development could. So, the expansion of Europe, the establishment of European military presence, was mainly a naval activity, underwritten by new technologies that had developed as Europe encountered Asian societies and utilized the contacts to their own benefit. It was developed in different ways in the Americas because of the very special circumstances that resulted, frankly, primarily from previous American isolation. A question obviously arises with regard to this European weapons advantage as to why no other society in the early modern period decided to rival the Europeans at their own game, and it's a valid question. Several societies doubtless could have done so because they had the metalworking traditions, they had the shipbuilding capacity, they had experience in interregional activity, but they did not do so. The Chinese, for example, although abundantly exposed to European example and interested in some European artifacts, for example, clocks, the Chinese decided not to imitate European patterns at this point, probably partly because of a Confucian reluctance to indulge too many activities that would give greater prestige to merchant values and merchant life, probably because of a bureaucratic suspicion of too much change occurring all at once. But above all, because China simply had no use for these patterns in terms of the purposes seen for Chinese society itself. As we will see more fully in a later discussion, China benefited hugely from Europe's world economy because of the Chinese productive capacity. They didn't need to emulate European weapons patterns and naval patterns in order to seize these benefits. China was interested in maintaining the integrity of the Middle Kingdom against outside invasion. European devices here, particularly naval devices, were of little use. The Chinese proved perfectly capable of organizing their contacts with Europeans through some regulated ports, particularly the port of Macau. They simply did not have problems that European weapons patterns would seem to solve. Something of the same case applies to Japan, although we know a little bit more about debates in this regard. As Europeans first encountered Japan in the 16th century, Japanese were initially rather interested in what the Europeans had to offer. There were even some significant conversions to Christianity. Japan was, after all, a warlike feudal society, and seeing a people with new types of weapons could be a real turn-on. And there was considerable interest in European guns and a quick capacity to manufacture similar types of guns in Japan itself. But at the end of the 16th century, under a ruler named Hideyoshi, the Japanese made a decision to cut off these contacts and to end this degree of interest in European weapons patterns. The decision was motivated first by a realization of what the Europeans were doing to the Philippines, a sense that European control of the Philippines in the name of the Pope, or so the Japanese viewed it, would be so threatening to Japanese culture, the Japanese value system, that the threat simply could not be endured. Japan needed to cut off contact lest what happened to the Philippines happen there. Second, it was clearly realized that while eagerness for European weapons might be a delightful edge for feudal belligerence in the short term, in the long term, European weapons would threaten the system of feudalism itself. Older fighting patterns were essential to maintain feudal values and feudal social relationships, and this maintenance was more important than the opportunities the Europeans seemed to offer. So Japan cut off this kind of interest, regulated the manufacture of guns. In some years in the 17th century, Japan produced only 9 guns per year. This was simply not going to be a dominant pattern for the Japanese political and military system. So, the sense that European patterns, although obviously extremely dynamic, were not relevant to the goals of key societies, a sense of social preservation or cultural preservation or both, motivated a stance toward European technology that was obviously very distinct. Europeans, in turn, quickly developed a sense that whatever their drawbacks with regard to the new societies they were in contact with, in the opulence of cities, the richness of tradition, at least they had a technology edge, and Europeans began to judge other societies mainly by the state of technology, and obviously in the process, found their own society vastly superior. An interesting pattern of evaluation that I think still operates in much of the contemporary world. Along with the rise of Europe and its military base, a second key development involved what historians routinely call the Columbian Exchange. Here's where the biological entry of the Americas into the global system had its clear expression. The Columbian Exchange means that biological products moved from the Americas to the rest of the world and from the rest of the world to the Americas. The exchange for the Americas themselves was almost entirely disastrous. Obviously, biological exchange meant that old world domesticated animals were brought to the Americas, and Americans proved very adept at using horses, for example, in this new system. Old world food products like wheat and other grains were also brought to the Americas, where they would embellish the food supply. But the big import biologically to the Americas was disease, and as we've already seen, it had horrendous impact. The impact was accidental. Europeans and Africans did not intend to bring these diseases to the Americas, though over time, by the 18th and 19th centuries, Europeans actually learned deliberately to introduce diseases into Native American populations in order to clear them out. It was initially accidental. It became sometimes intentional. The Columbian Exchange for other parts of the world was arguably beneficial, maybe a slightly loaded word, but beneficial may do. That is, American food products began to spread widely to other areas and enhanced food supplies in ways that would help sustain and even augment populations. China, for example, by the early 17th century, was utilizing American crops like sweet potatoes and corn, along with some new strains of rice in China itself, and this served as a basis for considerable population expansion later in the 17th and in the 18th centuries. China gained these crops mainly through their ongoing contact with the Philippines, where Spaniards had introduced American crops to see if they would also help improve the food supply there. The pattern obviously shows the continued complexity of China's relationship with the wider world and the capacity for real innovation. India also adopted some New World crops, and again, there were probably population consequences there as well. Europe, ironically, was slower to introduce New World crops. Europeans were very food conservative, arguing that these new crops were not mentioned in the Bible and therefore might be the source of evil and disease. But by the late 17th century, Europeans as well were beginning to use the potato. They used corn less, which remained mainly a food for animals, and on this basis would experience a dramatic population increase as well. The Columbian Exchange for the world as a whole served to augment the food basis for population growth, but in particular societies, particularly the Americas themselves, served as a population deterrent for a considerable period of time. The African involvement in the Columbian Exchange was obviously complicated. New World foods, particularly corn, spread widely to Africa and helped sustain population development. But here, there was another biological exchange in people themselves that worked in the other direction. Beginning in the 16th century, 8 to 12 million Africans would be seized in the Atlantic slave trade, taken to the Americas, often in hideous conditions, a level of displacement that had obvious population consequences for Africa, particularly West Africa, as a disproportionate number of the slaves were males and young, prime age for reproduction. So overall, in the early modern period, when these two forces are put together, African populations roughly stabilized, suffering in some regions, benefiting slightly in others. The most vigorous impact of the Columbian Exchange had ended by the early 18th century. Disease patterns began to stabilize in the Americas as more people became disease resistant and as the bulk of the population, now mixed European and Native American heritage in the mestizo group that would quickly become a majority. So the Columbian Exchange is not an eternal pattern in world history, but it did organize some very significant developments during much of the early modern period, some of which, including China's population growth, would continue to ramify thereafter. Third basic feature of the early modern period, the extent to which gunpowder was utilized to establish a new series of empires in a way that actually had never before been matched in world history. This was a great age of empire at two levels. First, familiar. The Europeans, launched by the Spanish and Portuguese, established their famous overseas empires in the Americas, in parts of Asia and Africa, as we've already discussed. So Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, British, French empires become the great overseas empires of the early modern period with huge consequences in world history. But equally important, indeed for much of the early modern period more important, was the establishment of land-based gunpowder empires in Asia. The Ottoman Turks, for example, had used cannon in their siege of Constantinople. The establishment of the Ottoman Empire was partly based on the use of land-based cannon and guns. The new Mughal Empire in India was similarly organized by invaders who utilized new weaponry. The Safavid Empire in Persia was another gunpowder empire. The expanded Russian Empire quickly became a fourth gunpowder empire. So, in Eastern Europe and much of Asia, a new series of empires arose on the basis of new military technology, quite different in orientation from the more commercially minded European overseas empires, but equally important because they maintained sway over such a significant landmass and over such dynamic economies. And even in China, the last dynasty, which launched in the 17th century, the Qing dynasty, was itself partly a gunpowder empire operated by Manchurians, not Chinese proper, who used new weaponry as one of their means of obtaining new political control on the Chinese mainland. This establishment of empire, which goes way beyond the familiar story of the rise of the West, is a crucial development in the early modern period that deserves attention in its own right. A couple of things did not happen in world history in this period. The early modern period is not a distinct period with regard to gender relations, for example. The post-classical period, with the complicated impact of the world religions on gender relations, but also the pattern of increasing subservience of women in a number of key societies, such as China, post-classical period suggests a break in gender relations, but in terms of the world as a whole, the early modern period did not. There were important developments. The arrival of Europeans in the Americas had huge implications for American gender relations because European values and expectations differed so greatly from Native American traditions. The slave trade, in withdrawing men from Africa, increased the importance of polygamy in Africa because of the need to provide family arrangements for the remaining women. Again, a significant gender change. So there are points of change in specific cases, but there's no blanket pattern that allows us to use the early modern period for purposes of gender discrimination. The same thing, interestingly, applies to culture. There are all sorts of cultural developments in the early modern period, and we will have to pay attention to them. The importation of European religion, artistic styles, and some science to the Americas was a huge change in American cultural history. European culture itself would change, and we'll be taking this up quite specifically with, for example, the rise of science, the division of European Christendom, etc. European cultural patterns would have some impact on a few other societies, particularly Russia, but in the world as a whole, in the early modern period, there is no overall cultural dynamic. It's as though, and I think in some cases this is really exactly the situation, it's as though individual societies like Japan, even as new opportunities for contact develop, decided, okay, we may indulge these to a degree, perhaps China would be a better example here, we may indulge these new contacts to a degree, but not at the expense of massive cultural influence. The Chinese, for example, would tolerate a little bit of European missionary activity as long as the Europeans were respectful of Chinese ways and dressed like Confucian scholars, but they were not interested in more significant cultural interpenetration, and indeed they would later move to block missionary activity to a greater extent as well. This is not a period of vibrant cultural exchange on a global basis. This is not a period of systematic cultural innovation. The main points in the early modern period are to recognize the obvious, that a number of different things are going on. The rise of Europe is a real fact. It doesn't have the same implications for some parts of the world as it does for others, but it's a real fact. But along with the rise of the West comes the establishment of really significant political units in other parts of the world that would long overshadow Western politics per se. Along with these political developments came the force of the biological exchange, which results from the inclusion of the Americas, a number of things going on that would prompt reactions from different societies. many societies did have to make some decisions about how to handle new contacts with the West, and these decisions varied. But they also had to make decisions about the utilization of new foods, reactions to new diseases. They also had to make decisions about the impact of new imperial structures, land-based as well as sea-based. A lot was going on, and different regions would react differently. One final point. I mentioned, and it really needs to be repeated, that along with the specifics, the gunpowder empires, the Columbian Exchange, etc., we need to keep in mind the central theme. And that central theme was the intensification of economic relationships, which now also included the Americas, and at the end of the period, parts of the Pacific, in ways that would have deep impact. And as one final caution against placing too much emphasis on Western achievements in this whole pattern, one interpretation argues that what the West really managed in the early modern period was to place itself as a transmitter of American goods, and it was this transmission that actually served as the engine of the world economy with much more diverse benefits and implications than we usually think of when we think of the rise of the West alone.